This week on Making Contact.
Democracy is just a theater. It's a spectator sport. You get to watch, you get to be played, but you don't get to shape the future of your city, your state, or your nation.
American democracy is the most expensive in the world. In the 2012 elections, billions of dollars were spent on political campaigns. But there's a growing consensus that big business and wealthy individuals are buying power. Authors John Nichols and Robert McChesney have a name for the state we're in: dollarocracy.
Instead of one person, one vote, you have $1, one vote. Those with the most money, lots of money, have all the power. Those with no money have no power.
On this edition, is money in politics part of the democratic process, or is it undermining it? I'm George Lavender, and you're listening to Making Contact.
I think if you looked at the history of the United States from, say, 1900 to around 1970, there were a series of major victories for democratic forces in this country that made this country a much better country, made it a more humane country than it had been 115 years ago. We won the right to have trade unions, effective trade unions, Social Security, Medicare. We spread education, public education, to working class people in a manner that no other country in the world could equal. And we had extended higher education to a higher percentage of the population than virtually any other country in the world. These are things we should be proud of. We extended the vote and the franchise from just being white males to basically the entirety of the adult population, including 18, 19, and 20-year-olds. These were great victories that we won between 1900 and 1970. We had our losses, if you're on the side of democracy, but we won these great victories. And I remember well, because this is my generation, that by 1970, this was despite all the war in Vietnam, despite militarism, despite racism. This was actually a very optimistic country. And in fact, in 1970, a survey was done of teenagers all over the world, and they found that American teenagers ranked among the three most optimistic groups of teenagers in the world, along with Israeli and Chileans. Chile fell off the list a few years shortly thereafter. But basically, that was where we were. We thought, despite all this country's problems, we could lick them. It was an optimistic moment. The winds of history were behind us. Well, as optimistic as I was as a teenager in 1970, there were lots of people who were not as optimistic. Or not many lots of people numerically, but lots of people of influence who were not as optimistic. In the business community, there was tremendous concern that this huge increase of interest in politics by young people, by people of color, by women, was gumming up the system. And in a famous report, they wrote that there was a crisis of democracy in America, and the crisis of democracy was that there was too much democracy. The crisis of democracy was that African Americans, people of color, women, young people, students, people who traditionally did not get involved in governing the country, were gumming up the works by getting active in politics. And to save democracy in America, we had to lower the amount of democracy and get those people back on the couch. In particular, what alarmed the business community was that business corporations were at their low ebb compared to other institutions and how they were received by the public. It was especially alarming to business in the early 1970s and late 1960s how many middle class and upper middle class young people were questioning whether we really needed large corporations as a rational way to run an economy, that their support, even among their core constituency of young people, seemed to be in decline. In 1971, the U.S. Chamber of Commerce commissioned a memo from one of the leading corporate attorneys in the country to say, how should the business community deal with this? This confidential memo was sent to roughly 50 or 60 CEOs and billionaires at the time for an internal discussion by the people who owned the country about basically how they should deal with the threat of too much democracy. The author was a tobacco industry lawyer named Lewis Powell. And you can find the memo, just Google Lewis Powell 1971 memo or Chamber of Commerce memo. You can read it. It's only 6 pages long, but it's a document that should be read along with the Emancipation Proclamation, the Declaration of Independence, the core documents of American history, because rarely is a single document so defined an era as much as Powell's memo would define. He was the architect of dollarocracy, and he would define what would come to follow since 1971 through to the present day. Powell argued in that memo that it was imperative that business take over the government. The business had been sitting on the sidelines and letting all sorts of people who had no business running the country run it. Business needed to increase its lobbying money dramatically. And as a shortly after the Powell memo began a period in which the business lobbying in Washington, D.C. increased by 10 times, a tenfold increase in the next two decades. The term K Street became a term like Wall Street or Madison Avenue to signify the industry of corporate lobbying, terms that didn't even exist in 1970 or 71. Powell said you needed to win the ideological battle and influence universities and media to be much more pro-business, and you had to make it that no matter who wins the election, business control of society will never be threatened or jeopardized. That's how democracy worked best, when no matter who wins the election, nothing changes. That was Lewis Powell's democracy. One of the other things Powell said is it's crucial that we have a Supreme Court and a court system filled with judges who are more sympathetic to business. One of the problems that had existed, according to Powell, was that even when allegedly pro-business presidents like Dwight Eisenhower or Richard Nixon were on the bench, they would appoint people who once they got their lifetime appointment would go rogue on them, people like Earl Warren. And they get all hung up on the First Amendment and the Constitution and the Bill of Rights, and they'd sort of take it seriously. Powell said, we have to make sure when someone gets in the court, they understand which side of the bread the butter's on, and we have people who always put the interests of business first and foremost. And they created the Federalist Society to be a farm system to make sure anyone who gets in the court would never go rogue on them ever again. Now, as fate would have it, just a few months after Powell wrote this memo, and it was spread like wildfire in the corporate community, there was an opening on the U.S. Supreme Court. And guess who Richard Nixon decided to appoint to the court? Lewis Powell. Lewis Powell joined the court, and when he joined the court, the one issue that he was singularly devoted to from the moment he got in the court was the idea that billionaires and corporations should be allowed to spend unlimited amounts on political campaigns. Now, at that time, and until really still through to this day, when that issue came up, people, other lawyers or reporters would try to deal with Powell's obsession with unleashing corporate and billionaire money on elections. The argument always was, well, that Lewis Powell, he's a very thoughtful moderate. He's just trying to come up with democracy in the modern times to deal with the modern nature of democracy. But when you read the Powell memo, that confidential memo, it becomes clear why he wanted unlimited corporate money in politics, because he wanted to rig the system to make sure his side would always win. And he knew if you could buy elections, your chances of losing would go way, way down. Powell never quite got his way. He was unable to get the Supreme Court while he was on it to agree to unlimited corporate or billionaire spending. But finally, he did get his way in 2010, long after he was gone, when Chief Justice Rehnquist was replaced by John Roberts, who was cut right out of the Powell playbook. And John Roberts was the lead author and architect of the Citizens United decision in 2010. That was the decision that allows unlimited billionaire and corporate spending on politics. It can't be officially with the formal campaign. It has to be what are called third-party groups. And to be accurate, it also said there was unlimited spending for labor unions. And some of the younger people in the audience asked one of the older people around you what labor unions are. They were these things we had a while ago in this country. In fact, Lewis Powell, one of the things he wanted to get rid of were labor unions. They were an enemy of theirs, not just for financial reasons, but for political reasons. But now we see the effect of Citizens United. And in the book, we chronicle what this great election looks like now in this post-Citizens United era. Already by our count, and there's no official record keeping, we have to do this research pretty much on our own, and by our count, almost $11 billion was spent in the 2012 election cycle in the United States on federal, state, and local races. Double what was spent in 2008. Double. And 10 times what was spent, even allowing for inflation, what was spent 25 years ago. And what we see also is this massive increase in money is the huge increase in what's called dark money. The Citizens United case said that this should be accountable, people should know who's giving the money, should be transparent. But, I mean, they said it shamelessly or cynically or ludicrously, because there was no mechanism to do this, and there is no mechanism. We really have no idea how much is being spent. We're still finding it out now, new caches of hundreds of millions of dollars from last year that we're coming across. And most of the money is increasingly the smartest version of this money. It's what's called dark money. It's going through a labyrinth of Cayman Island-style money laundering schemes, so we will never know who's putting up the money that pays for these campaigns. Now, a lot of Americans say, well, $12 billion, this is a big country, or $11 billion, that's not that much. I mean, gosh, that's a couple fighter planes, you know, if we're going to have a war. You know, who could care about that? Well, let's put it in context. For every dollar that was spent in Germany's national elections, for every dollar per voter that was spent in 2012, in our congressional and presidential race, just our national elections, the United States spent $34. We outspent Germany 34-1. Now, if you are a devotee of market economics or any sort of economics, say, wow, we outspent Germany 34-1. We must have really had much better elections than Germany. We must have really kicked their butt. I mean, we beat them 34-1. But it doesn't work that way with elections, does it? The more money you have in elections, the more bogus they are. That's the iron law of money in politics. The more money, more bogus. And there's a reason for this. First and foremost, the Citizens United decision, and there are people who make that argument, equates someone in this room or anyone in this country giving $25, $50, $100, even $1,000 to support a candidate with someone dropping $50 or $100 million anonymously to support a candidate or cause. And all evidence shows they are two entirely different phenomena. The first thing is people are just giving money because they believe in the civic process. They want to support a candidate, a set of ideas, certain values, whatever they might be. And, you know, that's not necessarily a bad thing. That's probably a good thing. And that's what the Supreme Court said. But all evidence shows that when someone starts getting up into the anonymous zone of 10, 100, 200,000, 100 million, 200, 300 million, like the Koch brothers, that it's not a civic virtue. It's not just that much they love their country that much more. It's a transactional expense. It's an investment in the political economy to get decisions you want that advance your interest. The Koch brothers are a perfect example of this. There's an argument to be made that the Koch brothers have given more money to liberal causes than anyone in the country. They do lots of support against the Patriot Act. They give money to the ACLU to oppose surveillance. They've been active in marijuana legalization. They've been active in same-sex marriage. They've looked at the prison industrial complex and looked at the racial component of it. They've supported all sorts of stuff like that. Lots of money, too, because they're rich guys. They've thrown a lot of money that way. But what's interesting about the Koch brothers is that it has no influence on when they go to buy a candidate for an election. When they go to pay for elections, they're only interested in candidates who are going to push their economic agenda. Low or no taxes, no regulation, smash labor unions, get rid of Social Security, public education, and Medicare, the big six. That's their game. That's what they want. Elections aren't about pushing civic ideals. They're about the political economy buying the government to make you richer and make you more powerful. That's why they do it. And that was the big lie behind Citizens United, that they're giving money to buy the government is the same as one of us giving $25 to support a candidate. Another reason why more money equals more bogus is, so where does this money go? Why do we have to spend so much more than every other country in the world on a per capita basis? Well, the majority of it goes to political ads on television, roughly $6 billion in the 2012 cycle. And 90% of those ads are what are called negative or attack ads. Those ads are illegal in most other democracies. You aren't allowed to have candidate ads, not to mention just negative ads. None of that's possible. Illegal in Britain, illegal in Germany, illegal in Sweden, illegal in Norway. You aren't allowed to do that. Political advertising on TV is considered like the equivalent of germ warfare in a military conflict. It's simply considered outside the boundaries of legitimate operations. Yet here in America, it's all we've got left. So people think that's the be-all, end-all of democracy. And the sad news about political advertising and the reason why it's so prevalent is that in the context of our two-party system, it works. Especially negative ads. They are very successful. And we document this at length in the book. They're not going away of their own volition. Another problem with the huge increase of political advertising is that we've created this enormous institutional lobby that benefits by marinating our political system in money. And this lobby is made up of media corporations that own all the local TV stations. The average local TV station in America got 2 or 3 or maybe 4% of its total revenues from TV candidate advertising. In 1992. In 2012, for the local TV station, the rate varied depending on the market you were in, from at the low end 15 or 20%, at the high end 35, 40, or 45%. It is the entire basis of the industry. And these stations, and these aren't owned by Ma and Pa, these are owned by a half dozen of the largest companies in the economy. These stations now are, to any sort of reform of our electoral system, what the NRA is to any sort of efforts to have gun control laws. They are a powerful institutional force for the status quo. And as they sell more and more political advertising, commercial broadcasters in this country have basically discontinued all campaign coverage, debates by candidates, free time for candidates, extensive journalist coverage of races, non-existent, even though legally that's the highest form of public service they're supposed to provide in order to get their monopoly licenses. They've stopped doing it. and the law is not being enforced in them. Now, that wouldn't be that big of a problem if we had journalism otherwise. If we had vibrant political journalism, we had a vibrant political culture with lots of news media, lots of reporters covering politics, then all these ads wouldn't be that powerful. But we have basically the opposite taking place. We're seeing the free fall, collapse, and disintegration of journalism as an institution in the United States in the last 10 or 20 years, which means the ads have that much more power. They're basically standalone. It's the only voices that are heard in politics today, which means those with the most money get to buy the terms of debate.
We'll be right back. You've been listening to author Robert McChesney. In just a minute, McChesney's co-author, John Nichols, talks about how the defeat of a 2013 ballot initiative in Washington State is dollarocracy in action, and why he's optimistic about the future. Stay tuned to Making Contact. Here's a heads up for our listeners. Making Contact has begun an investigative reporting project looking into the influence of big business on food policy and the political process. Check out our website, radioproject.org, for updates. You can also like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. Now, back to John Nichols speaking in Seattle shortly after the defeat of a Washington State ballot initiative that would have required companies to label genetically modified ingredients in most food and agricultural products.
Brothers and sisters, let me tell you, you have just been through dollarocracy. You do not need a couple of jokers from Madison, Wisconsin, to come to Seattle and tell you about the crisis, because pollsters in Washington State said that the people of this state were overwhelmingly in favor of labeling genetically modified food. Now, that didn't mean that, I'll be honest with you, I know that didn't mean that everybody was against genetic modification, didn't mean that everybody lacked a sophisticated view that some may be good, some may be bad. People had different views. But everyone, there literally is polling that showed, you know, we're getting into the high 70s, the 80s, and some surveys nationally, into the 90% of people saying they want to know what's in their food. They want to at least have that label on the front. But oh, Washington State, the threat was out there. Washington State might be the state that started putting the labels on the food. And so, in one of the shortest periods in American history, the most powerful food processors, the most powerful grocery makers in this country ponied up at a rate of $1, $2, $3 million contributions, and they flooded that money into the state of Washington. The most money ever spent on an initiative in the state of Washington to make people vote against what they wanted. Brothers and sisters, what you just went through is dollarocracy, and we got to stop it. Now, I'm going to tell you, you need to understand right up front from your own experience what dollarocracy is, how it works. It is a transactional relationship, not a transformational relationship. You seek to maybe transform the results of an election, but understand this is a transaction. This is what a rich person does to buy something. And the people who were engaged in the transaction here in Seattle and across this great state of Washington, this great progressive state where people actually care about what they eat, the transaction they were involved in was the darkest and cruelest of transactions, because they knew all of these giant companies, and you know, it was often said, oh, you're talking about Kellogg's, or you're talking about General Foods, you're talking about all these big companies. What's not talked about is the fact that all of these companies have rushed into the area of healthy food. They're all making your garden burgers and your veggie burgers. They're putting them into a frozen food rack there at the store. And they knew without a doubt that when a mom came in to buy veggie burgers for her kid, and she saw a label on the front that said, this is genetically modified food, that mother wasn't going to buy those veggie burgers anymore. And so they poured that money in, not because they believed in something, not because they wanted to influence a dialogue, to be a part of a great discussion. They poured that money in for a transactional purpose. They poured that money in to make sure that they maintained their corporate and business bottom line. That is what we have created in American politics, a circumstance where the most powerful companies in this world can maintain their income stream with a tiny investment of $22 million in Washington State, and that for them is a tiny investment. They can maintain their income stream, and they can do so by protecting their ability to deceive a mother who wants her child to have healthy food. Brothers and sisters, this is not a joke. This is not a game we're involved in. This is a democracy crisis, because when the wealthiest and most powerful people and corporations in a country can warp the very dynamics of democracy, when they can shift the sentiments of a great state in a matter of a few weeks with a huge inflow of money, then you have to ask yourself, where does that end? Where does that stop? Where does democracy end and dollarocracy begin? I submit to you, brothers and sisters, we saw the line drawn in Washington State. And if you are not angry enough to spend the next few years fundamentally transforming this electoral process in this country, fundamentally transforming our media so that it actually reveals these crises, if you're not willing to do that, then I warn you, the rest of your life will be far worse than what you've lived up to this point. It will be a dark turning point where you will ultimately begin to recognize that democracy is just a theater. It's a spectator sport. You get to watch, you get to be played, but you don't get to shape the future of your city, your state, or your nation. And that's not the way it's supposed to be. The story of this country, this great story of the American experiment, began in error, began in a terrible, terrible misstep. That is, at the founding of this country, and I am as patriotic as anybody you will see. I get a tear in my eye when I see that parade on the 4th of July, when I see that flag go by. But I will tell you that this country was founded in the original sin of allowing slavery. This country was founded in the original sin of denying the franchise to most Americans. At the founding of the American experiment, the group of people in this room would be more than enough people to elect a member of Congress. They used to have elections in this country in a room much smaller than this. 50, 75, 100 planters or wealthy business people, they would gather in a room and they would choose who would go to Congress to represent them. Now, the senators weren't even chosen in so small the democratic a circumstance. Senators were selected by the legislature, often appointed by the governor. But when they elected the House of Representatives 200, 220 years ago, in a room much smaller than this. And so the great mass of people would stand outside and look in and see their representatives chosen. They did not participate in the process. You could not participate in the process if you were a woman, because women were not allowed to vote. You could not participate in the process if you were a person of color, because persons of color, many actually enslaved, but even those who were not enslaved, not permitted to vote. And the most significant thing, often forgotten, is that at that founding state, most white guys weren't permitted to vote. Because if you weren't a rich white guy, you had to stand outside as well. And so the fact of the matter is, women, people of color, not rich white guys, all standing outside. That wasn't democracy. That wasn't even a facade of democracy. What it was a plutocracy. handful of wealthy people running everything. The fact of the matter is, if you can create a circumstance where everybody can vote, but that voting class can be manipulated by immense amounts of money, you can actually take the plutocracy of 1790 and put it back in power. You can create a circumstance where the people are outside looking in the windows while a small number of folks are inside making the fundamental choices about what happens in their country. And one of the reasons that occurs is because as money has flowed into our politics, journalism has stood down. Journalism has stood down in this country. We have lost since 2009 more than 20,000 newspaper employees in this country. We have closed daily newspapers across this country, in Albuquerque, in Tucson, in Kansas City, Kansas, in Denver, Colorado, and in Seattle, Washington. And as those newspapers have stood down, as radio stations since the Telecom Act of 1996 have laid off more than 20,000 on-air personalities, as television stations have shaved minutes off their newscast in order to fit in more ads, as we have seen journalism exit stage right, we end up in a situation where there is an information void, and that void is filled by the massive inflow of money. Do not doubt that the reason Washington State voted not to label genetically modified food was not just because of the massive inflow of money from out-of-state grocery processors. It was also because of the massive outflow of journalism in the state of Washington. When journalism stands down and money flows in, you create the perfect circumstance for a propaganda state, not a democracy. But, brothers and sisters, we are not disappointed and we are not discouraged because this is how America works. I hate to say it, but America is this great, big, wonderful, still relatively young country, and we're just like my 10-year-old. We know we should do our homework, but we don't do it until right before it's time to turn it in. We are a country that puts off reform and puts off change until we have to do it. The history of this country is a history of waiting till we reach the critical juncture and then recognizing that if we do not act, we will lose the country itself. It has happened again and again and again throughout our history. And we come to tell you today that we are at such a moment. We stand with the Washington Amend folks. We stand with the Move to Amend folks. We stand with the reformers who say it is time to amend the Constitution of the United States to say money is not speech. Corporations are not people. And we have a right to form a democracy, not a dollarocracy.
That was author John Nichols speaking about money and politics in Seattle, Washington in November 2013. Thanks to Pirate TV for their recording of that talk. And we want to hear from you. Do you think there's too much money in politics? Are we living in a dollarocracy? Have your say at radioproject.org or join the conversation on Facebook or Twitter. Our handle is making_contact. I'm George Lavender. Thanks for listening to Making Contact.